your Bod Pod. I am your host. I'm Kara Corinne Safeli. I'm a certified holistic health and anti-diet life coach. I'm also in training to be a breathwork facilitator, which is so freaking cool. I can't wait to have a couple of podcast episodes be some breathwork for you guys. Breathwork for negative body image, anxiety, emotional eating, binge eating. Who knows what they'll be breathwork for? I can't freaking wait, but stay tuned. It is coming. I'm in training right now. I'm going to be in training for another several months. So hang tight, but it is coming. I'm so stoked. Today on the podcast, we have an incredible interview with Iris McCulpin. She is a trauma professional, and we get into a wide range of topics all relating to trauma and self-care, self-sabotage, mental health, thought work as it relates to food, body, and beyond general in life. And this is one of those episodes where you are probably going to want to take notes. Iris drops so many little nuggets of wisdom and very practical, applicable tips that you can take with you and apply to your own life. They are amazing. They were so helpful and insightful and so generous of her to share with all of us her wisdom. And there's a lot for you to take away and apply to your own life from this episode. Before we get into that, just a quick little note about Food, Body, Soul, the membership. If you are not familiar, Food, Body, Soul, the membership is my monthly group coaching program and sisterhood where you will learn how to make peace with food, find confidence in your skin, and a deeper connection to yourself. Each month, we cover a highly requested topic or necessary step in the food freedom and recovery process. April's theme was restriction and the diet mentality. And May is going to be how to honor your hunger and fullness cues and reconnect to your biological instincts and build introspective awareness so you can cultivate trust with your body. And dieting, disordered eating, these things erode that connection and trust. And May is all about rebuilding that relationship. So if you're someone who feels like you are afraid of hunger, or you try to suppress hunger, or you don't know what hunger feels like, or any other stuff around hunger, or maybe you feel like you can't stop when you're full, you're a part of the clean plate club, or you are always, quote, eating too much, like you're eating past the point of comfortable fullness, and you want to learn how to honor your hunger and fullness, I invite you to join the wait list. Doors will be opening later this month, later in April, only for 2 days. So you want to get on the wait list so you get notified when those doors are open. You just go to foodbodysoul.co, foodbodysoul.co to join the wait list for Food, Body, Soul. So let's get into today's episode. Iris McCulpin is a trained trauma coach and NARM practitioner specializing in self-sabotage, eating disorder recovery, and complex trauma. After struggling with severe bulimia, PTSD and depression for over a decade, Iris became determined to understand what was truly at the root of her symptoms. It turned out the answer was trauma. She now spends her life helping people all over the world overcome similar struggles through trauma-informed education and coaching in both group and private settings. Iris is an incredible woman. She's a dear friend of mine. She has been a guest speaker in the Embodied Rebel Academy, if you're familiar with that group coaching program led by myself and Brandilyn Tebow. I'm really excited for this episode. There is just so much wisdom and juice in store for you guys. So without further ado, let's get into the interview with the lovely Iris McCulpin. Hi, Iris. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, I'm stoked to have this conversation as well. For people who aren't familiar with you or your work, can you give them a little bit of history, like who you are, and then also your history with food and body image and how you got into being a trauma professional?
So right now I am a trauma coach. I practice something called the Neuroaffective Relational Model, or NARM. And I use that for working with self-sabotage, complex trauma, and eating disorders and disordered eating specifically. And I got into this field because I struggled tremendously with my own mental health, with my relationship with food, my relationship with self, my relationship with body, all of these things for many, many years, and found recovery extremely confusing and difficult and painful. And I think there's some inevitability of it being difficult and painful, but I just somehow intuitively felt like it didn't need to be as hard as it was for me. And so I became kind of obsessively curious about understanding what was going on, and did a lot of research to try to figure out what was happening. And that kind of led me down the road to trauma. And really, like, I picked up a book on trauma by Peter Levine, and it started describing all of these symptoms that I had and experiences that I had that never made sense to me, that none of my therapists or coaches or anybody had ever been able to articulate. And so that just piqued my curiosity even further. And since then, I've done like hundreds and hundreds of hours of training and trauma, just really sunk my teeth into it.
Yeah, I think that's relatable, just in terms of really struggling with stuff and then wanting to then turn around and use that struggle to help other people.
Right.
Yeah. So for people who are listening, I think it's very common to think that trauma is this like huge event, but there is what is referred to as capital T trauma and then also lowercase t trauma. So can you explain the difference between those types of things?
Sure. Yeah. So big T trauma are things that most people typically think of when they think of trauma, like being in combat or in a war situation, being in a catastrophic car accident, natural disasters, basically threats to our physical body, our physical safety, and our lives ultimately. And then lowercase t traumas are things that are more threats to our sense of self. They often happen through relationships, and they may not be, you know, a threat to our lives and to our physical safety, but they are a threat to our emotional safety. And so it's interesting. It's kind of a controversial topic to some degree, but there's a lot of things to be said about this. But one thing we do know for sure is that people with a long history of lowercase t trauma are more likely, if they experience something physically threatening, to develop PTSD. So there is some interplay between these two things for sure.
So for somebody who maybe isn't sure that they've experienced, or who is positive they haven't experienced the big T trauma, but they're curious if maybe they've experienced some type of lowercase t trauma, how would somebody know? Or like, what could they look for within themselves? Maybe it's behaviors, maybe it's thought patterns, to know that maybe some healing work is necessary or would be beneficial.
Yeah, this is such a complex question, just because there's like almost infinite possible things to look for. But I mean, I would say generally speaking, if you're moving through your life and you're not experiencing a ton of resistance, if you're not self-sabotaging, if your relationships are healthy, if you're generally able to pursue the things that you love and like find fulfillment, the need to go digging around for past trauma just seems sort of unnecessary. If, on the other hand, you do notice that you self-sabotage, if your relationships are fraught with challenges, if your relationship with food is fraught with challenges, you find yourself being hypercritical of yourself, these kinds of things, there might be something there. It may not necessarily be trauma, but there might be something worth exploring. And really, honestly, after 2020, I just feel like we could all use mental health support. And I think for a lot of people, things got kind of brought up to the surface from that experience that in some cases were quite surprising. I just think this idea that we don't need any help processing our lives and our like human consciousness is just, I don't know. I feel like we could all use some help with that.
I'd love to go a little bit deeper there if you have more to say. So you had said, you know, some things had gotten brought up to the surface. So what exactly do you mean? Like maybe some, what are some actual examples of maybe what you've heard from people? And why do you think so many of us don't think we need help processing our everyday lives?
Got it. Yeah. Well, I think I'll start with the second one and then get to the first one. I think culturally, especially in, I think we're around the same age, like our parents' generation and prior to that too, there was kind of this cultural attitude of like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and like, don't talk about your personal problems, stiff upper lip, you know, especially for people like myself who have British heritage, there's a lot of that type of ethos. And so the idea of talking to people about your problems was really strange for a long time, like very taboo, very stigmatized. And in certain cultures, it very much still is. And so we're sort of fighting against that messaging that many of us have been given since we were born, basically, and some of us maybe from our families are still getting. And then in terms of what's coming up for people, man, a lot of different things. I mean, for sure, I know people's romantic partnerships have been very challenged. Had a lot of clients and even just friends who have gone through major relationship turmoil or relationships have ended. And I think, you know, when we're not used to sitting with ourselves without distraction, this is not something we're really taught how to do. And we live in a culture that's historically been super fast paced and like very productivity oriented and accomplishment oriented. And so this idea that we're just going to hunker down, and even if we're still working, there's a lot of togetherness with many fewer distractions. And so that's been really hard for people who are, well, I'd say that's been hard for couples, but that's also been very difficult for people that are single in different ways. So that's been coming up a lot, just like issues of like, who am I without all of these distractions or these activities? And there have been major issues that have come up for people around food. And I'm sure you've seen this in your practice as well, where at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a lot of stuff coming up for people around food scarcity, like going into the grocery stores and seeing empty shelves. And maybe if you have certain foods that you really rely on that feel safe and those are gone, that can be super anxiety producing. And then on the flip side, having to have large amounts of food in your refrigerator and in your pantry when maybe that's been challenging for you before, all of a sudden needing to stock your house full with 2 weeks, that's like a huge trigger for people as well. And these are things that maybe some people may have been conscious of this, but you're sort of thrust into a situation where it's like in your face, there's nothing you can do. And so I think there's a lot of fears and anxieties around that and feelings of helplessness that we're often not really practiced in dealing with. So, I mean, I could go on, but there's a lot of things that have been coming up for people for sure. Not to mention loss. I mean, goodness,
right?
So much loss.
Yeah. No, those were great examples. It really like put me on the court with you, so to speak, of like what some of those things are. And I read a statistic, I don't know, a couple of months ago that like the divorce rates have just climbed through the pandemic. So I can really relate to that. And of course, with the food thing for sure. Yeah. So you've mentioned self-sabotage a couple of times now. Can you define what self-sabotage is? How do we know if we're doing it? Why do we do it? What are some examples?
Yeah. So self-sabotage, there are a lot of possible definitions. The one I just kind of fall back to is that it's just self-defeating behavior. And there are like some examples that people don't often think of as self-sabotage that I consider self-sabotage are things like people-pleasing or not setting boundaries, procrastination, that one is pretty common, starting projects and then never finishing them, like negative self-talk is another one that maybe people don't think of as self-sabotage, but it really doesn't work. So it is self-defeating. So I consider that self-sabotage. And then, I mean, there's so many examples, but those are some that come up a lot. And I think the most common one is beating ourselves up and being really, really hard on ourselves.
So why do we do this? Like, is it a protective mechanism? Are we doing it because it's a lack of self-worth? Like, what might be some of the reasons why somebody would engage in these self-defeating behaviors? Was that the right words? Self-defeating
sure,
behaviors?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I have a program for self-sabotage that's 8 weeks long. And so it takes quite a bit of time to unpack this fully, but the short version is that self-sabotage behaviors are often behaviors that originated in our early lives when we didn't have a lot of tools and resources at our disposal because we hadn't developed them yet to deal with difficult circumstances. And in some way, they either protected us or made us feel better or made it just easier to cope with things that we didn't know how to cope with. And then as we get older, even though we may have more capacities and more resources, because we have this really well-formed habit that's been rewarded over time, it stops being effective, but we keep it around because we don't really know anything else. And so that's sort of the very simplified version of how it originates, but it's usually at this like child part of us trying to get our needs met in the best way that it knows how.
That last line makes a lot of sense. So like, for example, if we grew up in like a really chaotic household or like our parents were always upset, we might've learned as a child to really people please and do what we can, yeah, whatever we can to make them happy, to avoid upsetting them. But then later in our life, people pleasing could result in what, for example?
Can result in a lot of things. I mean, it can result to like working yourself into the ground because you're doing things for other people that you don't have the bandwidth to do. Kind of on the more extreme end, it can have us be in really unhealthy, possibly even abusive relationships because we just want to keep people happy. And, you know, more commonly I see people just running themselves into the ground and then developing resentment in their relationships because they really want to say no to things, but they don't really know how, and that feels too threatening. And so they just keep saying yes. And meanwhile, the resentment builds, and then over time relationships can implode from that or explode.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to go deeper into the self-critical form of self-sabotage. Can you share a little bit more about that? Like perhaps what type of situations could result in us being super hypercritical of ourselves? What's the impact that it has on our lives when we're super self-critical?
Sure. Yeah. So there are a number of different things that can create that, but the most common one that I see is having hypercritical parents. And sometimes parents with good intentions are just, you know, trying to like help us match what they think society's expectations are so that we can be successful. But if you have very hypercritical parents, then any sort of self-expression or like inspiration or motivation that wasn't directly in line with what our parents thought we should be doing and was then criticized, that's really painful for a child. We can look at that from the adult lens and say like, well, you know, it wasn't so bad. They were trying their best. But when we're 2 or 3 years old, that can be really crushing. And so as a protective strategy, a very effective one is we can internalize that critical voice and create our own inner critic. And that becomes then a buffer. It's like, I'm going to criticize myself first. I'm going to like keep myself in line in this way so that I don't have to risk the pain of being criticized by somebody else. And it works to a degree, in the sense that it might make external criticism slightly less painful, but then we're just criticizing ourselves all the time. And that is incredibly painful and can cause a lot of harm over time in terms of our relationship with ourselves.
So what if somebody is aware that they're self-critical and they don't know how to stop, or they have fear around stopping. What can you say to that? Or what would you say to somebody who's maybe in that position?
Yeah, a few things. I mean, I'm definitely going to advocate for getting support with it because there's usually a lot of stuff wrapped up in this. So trying to completely solve it by yourself, I think is hard. Maybe possible, but certainly hard. The other thing that I would say, you know, a technique that I teach a lot, because a lot of times people think, okay, if I'm criticizing myself, then I'm going to try to do the opposite. I'm going to like say affirmations, or I'm going to say really nice things to myself. And it's a lovely idea, but I've just found from my own experience and with clients that it doesn't usually work very well if there's not full buy-in or belief. Like, if you don't think you're wonderful and beautiful and brilliant, like telling yourself that isn't actually going to move the needle very much. And so what I do and what I encourage other people to try and see if it helps is to apologize to yourself if you say something really harsh to yourself. So like, for example, one day I was at an exercise class with those like giant mirrors, and I caught a glimpse of myself from an unflattering angle and had a really rude thought, like, you look like crap. And I noticed that and I was like, wow, I'm so sorry. Like, that was real. That was not a nice thing to say. That was an unflattering angle. Like, don't worry about it. And I was able to just be more neutral with myself. And from that day onward, I started doing that because it really worked. Because ultimately, we do have a relationship with ourselves, and the way we speak to ourselves is a huge part of what creates either a healthy or a challenging relationship. So just noticing if you say something harsh, apologizing, and then if there's something positive that you actually believe, great, you can tack that on, or just saying something a little bit more neutral, like, you know, you're trying the best you can, or something along those lines can go a long way.
Yeah, that's a great little super practical like nugget that people can take with them and start implementing right now. So thank you for that.
One thing I will say about that really quickly is a lot of people are like, that sounds so weird. And I just want to point out that it's just interesting that people think it's weird to apologize, but not weird to say you look like crap, or not weird to say like, oh, you're such a screw up. If that's not weird, then apologizing to yourself is not weird. So just want to throw that in there.
Yeah. So kind of building on that, thank you for that, by the way. Yeah. It's a good question to be like, it's not weird to tell yourself that you're a piece of crap. Like, I loved that. So how can telling ourselves that we're not good enough be a way to protect ourselves? So maybe there's something here that's connected to the self-critical voice as self-sabotage. But I do remember you posting something on Instagram about how telling ourselves we're not good enough can be a way to protect ourselves.
Yeah, there's a couple different ways. The first one that's a little bit easier to dig into is that if we're constantly telling ourselves that we're not good enough, just like foundationally not good enough, it usually stops us from trying, which is a way, in a sense, to protect us from failure. It's like, if I'm not good enough, then obviously I can't go start a business because I'm going to fail because I'm not good enough. So I'm just not even going to look into it. I'm not going to do the work. I'm just going to hang out here in my safe little comfort zone. And it works for that pretty well, in the sense that you probably won't fail in that way. And I guess the way I've sort of reframed it for myself, at least, is that if I'm always holding myself back, if I'm always telling myself I'm not good enough, then I'm failing myself in a way. And so it's a trade-off. It's like, do you want to risk the pain of failure, which is possible, of course, or do you want to sit in like smaller amounts of pain every single day because you're not going for it and trying this thing that you're interested in or passionate about?
Yeah, because then you miss out on having that This reminds me of Stephen Hayes, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. He talks about the pain of presence and the pain of absence. Yeah. And so the pain of presence would be, like you said, that little bit of like mini discomfort that we experience every day while we're chasing after that dream. And the pain of absence would be the pain of living with the fact that we never really got to have what we wanted in our life because we kept telling ourselves we weren't good enough. So we didn't even try.
Yeah. Or even the pain, let's say you do go after it and it doesn't work out. Like that can be really painful too, but it's like, it just seems like, and I talked about this in a slightly different context on Instagram as well, but it applies here. It's like, if we want to avoid pain and like shove everything down, it's sort of like paying $1 a day for the rest of our lives rather than paying one like $100 fine. And so it's kind of the same thing. It's like, yes, failure can be quite painful for a short amount of time, but never trying, never following your dreams for a lifetime is a lot of pain when you really add it all up over time. So it's a calculation, and I don't think there's like a right answer or a wrong answer, but I just think it's easy to kind of lie to ourselves and say, well, no, this way I'm saving myself pain, when we're not.
Yeah. It's kind of convenient way of rationalizing.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So are there other ways that telling ourselves we're not good enough can be protective in some ways, but then eventually be harming us down the line?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, another, I don't know if this quite matches this last piece that you said, but I haven't really articulated this out loud very often, so I'll see if I can do this justice, but I think there is some reality to the fact that in the grand scheme of things, nobody really knows what's going on. Like, we're on this spherical rock hurtling through space. Like, we don't really have a complete understanding of how we got here, or how consciousness evolved, or all of these things. And so I think there's something very comforting, especially when we're children, to look at adults, to look at other people and think, okay, they must have it figured out and I don't. They must know more. They must have answers. They must have skills. They must have all of these things that we don't have, to kind of create a sense of security or safety. And I think, and I've talked to a lot of people that are sort of at the top of their fields, there's often this feeling of like disillusionment and sort of an uneasiness for people that can come when they become like the expert in their field, because we often don't relate to ourselves as having all the answers or being the most knowledgeable. It's, that can feel kind of like unsettling. And so I think in a way, telling ourselves I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, like all these other people know so much more and have all these answers that I don't, can be a way, it's like a security blanket of sorts.
You articulated that well.
Okay, good. Yeah. And I think that feeds into imposter syndrome too. You know, it's like, no, I couldn't possibly know or like be at this level. Somebody else must know so much more than me. Somebody must be so much more qualified.
Yeah. Do you want to sort of define imposter syndrome and like what that, for anyone who's not familiar? I think that's a very common feeling, at least maybe amongst like, online entrepreneurs. I want to say like in the coaching world is very common, but I don't know if like that's maybe like a, I don't know if that's like a term that I learned prior to this career. So I'm curious to hear more.
Yeah. It's feeling fraudulent on some level, like that the level of skill and knowledge that you have doesn't match people's perception of you. So I see it a lot in the corporate arena too, where somebody will get a promotion that, you know, for me, like as their coach sitting on the other side, I'm like, of course you got that promotion. You're like the perfect person for that job. But for them, they're like, no, but somebody else would be more qualified and I don't have this and I don't have that. So that's kind of, it often shows up in professional arenas, but it can show up in relationships as well, feeling like, oh, if this person only knew how messed up I was, then they would run away screaming. So yeah, it kind of shows up all over the place.
So I'd love to shift gears here a little bit. Okay. One of the things that you have said on your Instagram is that there's no such thing as a negative emotion. Mm-hmm. So can you explain your point of view on this, your perspective on this? And then I'm assuming I'll have some follow-up questions. But one thing that I am curious about is, you know, why do we think certain emotions are negative in our culture? And maybe it just goes back to what you were saying earlier, but I'd be curious if there's more to add.
Probably. I mean, the reason I say there's no such thing as a negative emotion is that emotions are just information. They're giving us information. So like, for example, people often think pain is a negative feeling. And emotional pain and physical pain sort of function similarly. Like if we weren't able to feel pain physically, we would probably die very quickly because we would accidentally hurt our, I mean, this is a documented medical phenomenon. I can't remember what it's called, but people who don't feel pain get injured a lot because they can't, or their body isn't giving them signals to stop doing something that's bad. So emotional pain is similar in a sense that it tells us like something's not quite right here. Like something about the way this is happening isn't the way we want it to keep going. Like this isn't good. And anger is another one that people often don't like, but anger is really a communication of whatever is happening right now is not okay with me. Like this is a violation of a boundary. I have a need that's not getting met. There's an injustice that's being perpetrated. You know, it's telling us that something's not right. And while that's not usually pleasant to feel, if we were completely disconnected from that, it would make it very difficult to create any kind of change, either like within ourselves or even in the culture at large. And so these challenging emotions that do carry with them a lot of energetic charge and take some skill and practice really learning how to sit with them without just like acting on them impulsively. But these emotions can be powerful catalysts for healing and for change. And so that's why I don't really believe that there's any such thing as a negative emotion. They're just information, and it's very useful information.
Love that, by the way. Great. Loved the analogy, or not the analogy, but the other like data that you had brought in about people who don't feel physical pain get hurt all of the time. Yeah. So like actually being able to feel physical pain is a helpful thing. That was a really great like analogy for us to kind of connect it with the emotional pain. Really beautiful.
Great. Thank you.
Yes. I love that.
And you asked a second part of that. I'm blanking on what it was. Why I think we are afraid of these emotions.
Yeah, or associate them as being negative as opposed to being the teachers that they are, the information that they are.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, anger is one I just am super interested in general. I just find it sort of a fascinating emotion just because it is so villainized. But I think we're not really taught to distinguish between states and behaviors, like emotional states or behaviors. And so a lot of people, when they're angry, they do things that I would consider negative or harmful. They lash out in violence or, you know, verbally assaulting people and those kinds of things. Obviously not great for that to happen, but that's distinct from anger, but they're often collapsed in the way we conceptualize them. And so I think really what I would love to see happen, and I know it is happening in some places, is for young people to get some education on learning how to tolerate the energetic charge that comes with some of these emotions, because it really does. I mean, it can feel like your fingers plugged into a socket if you're really angry. There's a lot going on. And if you don't have any skill or training or awareness that you have some control over what you can do with that, like there are healthy ways to channel that, then yeah, the default may be to act out in ways that are not helpful for you or for the people around you. And so I think generally more broadly, I would love to see more people distinguishing between the behaviors and the states. And then for children, I think especially, getting some emotional intelligence education and learning that these things don't have to be bad, that they can be conducive of actually developing more connection if we can just be honest with each other about what we're feeling. So
yeah,
fingers crossed.
I think it's happening. I don't know if it's going to necessarily happen right away, like with like schools per se, yeah. like, you know, make its way through the public school system. But I do think that it's happening, you know, like you had said, with our parents' generation, they had this very like hush, hush, she went to therapy, you know, whereas like, we're very outspoken as a generation of like, dude, this is what my therapist just said, right? Or like, right. hey, I'm working with this person. So I think just in that respect, like it's shifting and we're obviously going to translate that to those of us that have kids, I hope, or I assume.
Yeah.
I am curious if you would be willing to share a bit more about why anger is so interesting to you. This is partly like a self-indulgent question. Like I would love to know.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to me because I used to not even believe that it exists in the sense that I sort of bought into a lot of spiritual or maybe pseudo-spiritual thinking that like that anger is just grief in disguise, or that, well, I certainly bought into the idea that anger is like unenlightened or not transformed or negative, you know, like I bought that for large portions of my life. And I also had, my anger was so suppressed and turned inward that I didn't really ever get angry outwardly. Like I can think of like three times prior to the age of maybe 26 or something that I can actually remember getting angry. And it was a very distressing experience for me because I had suppressed so much. So I think I've just gotten interested in it in the sense that I feel like it's very misunderstood, very like misrepresented. And I also am interested in it because like tapping into it and reclaiming it in a sense and being curious about my own anger just freed up so much bandwidth for me. Like I had no idea how much energy I was spending just like holding that all down. And so I just feel like, I mean, this is not the reason to do it, but it is true for me that my ability to just be productive has exponentially increased because I just am not exhausted all the time from holding all of that down. So yeah, I think there's a lot of potential, I guess, that comes with anger. I think, and we saw some of it this year. There were a lot of things to be angry about, and people started expressing that in bigger ways and in different ways. And some things have changed some things have changed that I don't think are positive, but some really have changed. You know, some police reform and things that have happened are really positive. And so I think I think it's bad to demonize it wholesale and that it can be used in some really beautiful ways.
Yeah, I think anger can totally be challenged into social change or any type of Absolutely. Positive change.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to share maybe what some of the things, and maybe that you have some practical tips for people listening, practical tips on how to meet your anger or express your anger or process your anger in a helpful, healthy, dare I say, productive way, as Sure. opposed to suppressing it or punching a hole in the wall, for example?
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you used the punching a hole in the wall example. Cause I actually, and I learned this the hard way. Cause I earlier in my coaching career, I went to a number of different workshops and things that really advocated for like unleashing it all at once and like beating things with pool noodles and stuff like that. Which is kind of fun, but I actually, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, that can actually be quite destabilizing and flood your nervous system, especially if you're not used to expressing anger at all. And so the key to it is titration, or like baby steps, basically. I mean, I think really what can be, I mean, again, sound like a broken record, but I'm going to say it again anyway, getting some help with it, like talking to somebody, a professional about it, I think is very helpful because it can feel like a lot. Like I said, it can feel like being plugged into a socket. It's a lot of energy. It can feel distressing to tap into that. And so trying to do that alone, I think it depends on what your past experience is. If if you don't have a lot of trauma, then maybe it won't be too overwhelming for you. But if you do, which was my experience, I really needed that help. I think it would not have gone well otherwise for me. But I think noticing it, just acknowledging like, oh, okay, I feel angry right now. Noticing what that feels like, being curious about how that experience is, like noticing the physical sensations, noticing the thoughts, like bringing that sort of reflective lens to it can be helpful. And then again, like processing with someone, journaling is a big one. Like if I notice that I'm really angry about something and I know relationally that it would be a mistake to just like unleash that on someone, which often it is, unless, you know, you're really defending yourself in a way that's needed. But just writing it out, like getting it out on paper, getting it out of your head and out in front of you can help process some of that as well. So I think, yeah, curiosity, like bringing curiosity to your experience, getting support and writing it out are three kind of tangible things that people can do.
Yeah, thank you for that for sure. Okay. So we've been kind of talking about this a little bit and you had just mentioned it as well about bringing curiosity to our different emotions, but there's so many of us that automatically approach our emotions with judgment, and shame and criticism and suppression and avoidance, or like you had mentioned earlier, like reacting into like coping mechanisms. What are some things that we can do to rewire our thoughts from that place of judgment and shame? And maybe it's a super simple, trade it for curiosity, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, that is the simple thing, but in practice, that can be challenging if you don't know what that looks like. And so, yeah, and I recently did a post on this because I think it's one of those things that gets thrown around, like replace judgment with curiosity. And it's like, cool, how? And so I think part of it, it might help if I just think of some examples. Well, this one comes up a lot for people. They'll get upset about something and think, I shouldn't feel so upset. Like this shouldn't be, I shouldn't feel this way. Like, what's the big deal? And if you notice that kind of judgment come up, a question that I really love to ask, and I ask it all the time to myself and to clients, is what's right about being upset right now? Like what makes sense about this? Because I think, you know, when it comes to self-sabotage, when it comes to our emotions, so many different things, there's this tendency to think there's something wrong with us or that this shouldn't be happening. And there is logic to all of these things. There are good reasons for all of these things. We don't just start doing things for no reason out of thin air. Our emotions just don't appear arbitrarily. Like, there is a reason for it. And so instead of thinking what's wrong with me, it's like, what's right with me? What makes sense here? What's smart about this? I think can be extremely powerful as we're learning to relate to ourselves differently.
Yeah, that's a great tool and a tip that people can take with them, you know, of investigating it a little differently for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've been talking about this, this whole time. This past year has been really difficult. 2020, and we're now in 2021 while we're recording this, but it's been hard. It's triggered a lot of us to feel that they could have been more productive. They could have achieved more. They could have helped others more, et cetera. In your opinion, how can we take the first steps towards self-compassion? Not only with this past year and all of the things, but I think also in general.
Yeah. A way to sort of bootstrap self-compassion, if that's something that's difficult for you. There's one of two ways that immediately come to mind. The first being to think about, to sort of externalize your perception in the sense that, like, how would you feel about a friend and with all the same circumstances that you have, who is having a hard time in a global pandemic, maybe with income interruptions or, you know, childcare challenges, or who knows, like whatever you're dealing with, if somebody that you really loved and cared about had all those same circumstances and told you, I should have done more, how would you respond to that? And I could be wrong, and there are definitely exceptions, but a lot of times we would be much more gracious with the people that we care about than we are with ourselves. And so that can be a way to kind of at least like crack the door open into maybe being hard on myself here isn't warranted. And this one doesn't always work, because sometimes people just agree with this, but it's sort of, how would you feel if somebody came to you and said, like, you should be doing more? Typically, when that happens, we start to think, but like, wait, but no, like, my whole life got thrown upside down and everything was in upheaval and there was so much stress and like everything on the news that was going on in the election. And, you know, we can start to defend ourselves and realize, actually, yes, like there was a lot going on. There was a lot to process for many of us. You know, there were just like thing after thing that was unexpected that we had to like pivot and manage. And so that can be another way to tap into that.
Yeah, those are two great strategies and tools. So I think it's so common for us to be much harder on ourselves than we would say a friend or somebody that we really cared about in a variety of areas of life, whether it's about your productivity or about your parenting skills or about like your weight and how you're eating.
Yeah.
From like your lens with your trauma background, why are we so much harder on ourselves than other people?
Yeah. Well, because gosh, I'm trying to think of, again, sort of how to synthesize this relatively quickly. I mean, the shortest possible answer to that is that self-compassion in childhood is often threatening to our primary attachment relationships, our relationships with our parents, or may not be our parents, could be our caregivers. But essentially, because when we're little, our relationship with our primary caregivers is absolutely essential for our survival. Like babies cannot survive without care. We will essentially abandon ourselves to maintain connection if our needs feel threatening to the relationship, if our emotions feel threatening to the relationship, if being compassionate towards ourselves would be threatening to the relationship. We'll just abandon all of that just to maintain that connection. And this is a really smart survival response. And we learn that in early age. Like babies aren't, I mean, especially babies, but even small children aren't really capable or don't have the capacity developed yet for self-compassion. It's easy to like look at our parents and think that they have it all figured out together and that we're the bad ones. And that's not by accident. That has been a part of our survival strategy as a species for as long as we've been around, probably. And so once we get older and self-compassion is safer, because we still have that sort of well-formed pathway in our minds, it can be challenging to access. It can feel downright terrifying to access. So it takes some time and patience with ourselves as we start to cultivate that.
That's very insightful. It makes a lot of sense that what I could feel so hard or so scary. Because you can, I think, yeah, with your intellectual adult brain, understand that self-compassion isn't scary.
Right.
And yet still really have that like a body response, those emotional sensations that this is scary, this is threatening, and yeah, not really fully understand why.
Exactly. Well, and it also can trigger grief or rage or some other feelings, because let's say some really not okay things were happening in your childhood home. To really start to have compassion for yourself for that experience can bring up waves of grief that maybe have been held at bay, or rage that's been held at bay. And so self-compassion, the way I think about it, is that it's really like reconnecting to the self in a deep way. And there's a reason why we disconnected usually. And so I just say that to just, you know, be patient with yourself and gentle with yourself. If that's something that you're wanting to access, that it doesn't usually just turn on like a light switch. And so to just take baby steps with that.
This has been so great. We have two last little questions to wrap us up here. Okay. We're coming up on our time. What are you most excited about in life right now?
Oh, what am I excited about? I mean, I'm very excited about the vaccine and just like, you know, my grandma getting it. She's 90. So I'm very excited about that. I'm also, I don't talk about this on social media really, but my husband and I are trying to start a family and I'm really excited about that.
Oh, that's so exciting. I'm going to cry.
Yeah, it's really, can't wait.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that. So yeah. Iris, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your heart with us and so many practical tools that people can take away. I really feel like this was a gem-packed episode. If people want to learn more about you, I know you had mentioned your 8-week program, Bloom, but if they want to connect with you, learn more, where should they go? How can they find you?
Definitely Instagram, just because I have a ton of content on there. And then it has in my bio a link to everything else you could possibly want to find about me. So it's just my name at Iris McAlpin on Instagram.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Iris, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Wait, don't go yet. Did you get a lot out of this episode? Did you enjoy it? Did you learn something? If you did, one of the most helpful things you can do in return is to leave a ratings and review on iTunes for the podcast, or to share it with a friend, or share it in your Instagram stories. That really, really helps keep the podcast going. It helps it reach more people. It lets me know you're listening, and it just puts a really big smile on my face. I am always so grateful when I see those reviews and shares. So if you got a lot out of the pod today, please leave a ratings and review or share it with a friend. I love you all. I'll see you next week.